The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we are celebrating Earth Day. And we've invited individuals who have contributed in the past, are doing so now, and will give us insights that I believe can inspire us and direct us in paying more attention to what's important. My first guest is live in our studio in New York City. She is Dr. Vandana Shiva. Then she will be followed by Dr. David Corton, who is one of our nation's most important visionary economists, historians, and critics of free market globalization. He is in the progressive community. He was formerly professor of Harvard University School of Business, and he'll be giving us his insights on globalization and our environment. Jeffrey Smith, one of our foremost experts on health and environmental risks of genetically modified organisms, and a leading watchdog over corporate agriculture's manipulation of genetically modified genetic science and public opinion. He is also founding director of the Institute for Responsible Technology. Naomi Klein, award-winning journalist, author of the New York Times international bestsellers The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which has also been made into a documentary film. And in an internet poll, Naomi was ranked 11th of the top global intellectuals living today, and in a listing of top thinkers by Foreign Policy Magazine, was the highest-ranked woman. She is a former Miliband Fellow at the London School of Economics and holds a doctorate law of civil law from the University of King's College, and she'll be on as well. Let us now go over to our first guest standing by. Many people know her work. She is an inspiration, and she can talk on a lot of topics. Dr. Shiva is an internationally renowned environmental and social activist and was formerly one of India's top nuclear physicists. She has been credited as the principal founding leader of India's ecological and ecofeminism movement. In 1982, she founded the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology in New Delhi, which led to the creation of a very important organization dedicated to the restoration of organic farming all across India, as well as the preservation of indigenous knowledge and culture. She is also one of the leaders on the board of International Forum of Globalization with Ralph Nader and Maud Barlow and Jerry Mander, who we've all had on this program. And for several decades, Vandana has fought for changes in the globalized practice of agriculture and food. And she's also the author of Earth Democracy and Manifestos on the Future of Food and Seed and Soil, Not Oil, Environmental Justice and Age of Climate Crisis. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be here on your show, Gary.
When you take a look back at Earth Day, and I'm sure many people in this audience certainly know it, but Earth Day was founded on April 22, 1970 by U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. And it was not until 1990 that Dennis Hayes made it international, and the UN only designated this day as the International Mother Earth Day in 2009. Rather curious that the origins of Earth Day are in the United States, but the U.S. is probably the largest culprit in failing to develop that awareness and appreciative respect for the Earth's natural resources and life. And it's also interesting that Senator Nelson found his inspiration for this day after a trip to Santa Barbara, California, following the well-known horrific oil spill off the coast in 1969. And it was his outrage at the oil industry and government collusion with the oil industry that prompted him to create this day for teach-ins across American campuses so younger generations would become aware of humanity's ability to devastate the environment. So this day marks the birth of modern environmental movement with over 2,000 college campuses and 10,000 primary and secondary schools participating. So take us on this journey, if you will, from your perspective to show us what do you believe that we have learned in the last 40 years and what have we not learned. What has become of the environmental movement, and what do we need from this point forward so that we can really do something constructive?
If I look back, Gary, over the last four decades, the 70s were really where the new ecological consciousness was being born with the CHIPCO movement in my part of the world. That's how I entered environmental activism. This was the movement named after hugging trees. The women came out and said, these forests are our mothers, these trees are sacred, they provide us everything we need, the food, the fodder, the fuel, and you cannot kill the tree without killing us. That's why the act of embracing the tree became an act of the highest level of non-violent non-cooperation. And by 1981, we managed to get a national logging ban in the High Himalaya, totally from grassroots action. CHIPCO shaped the consciousness of modern environmentalism in India just as much as Rachel Carson with her Silent Spring shaped the recognition that we were relating to nature on terms of war. War chemicals that had been left surplus after the Great Wars ended were now deployed into agriculture, the pesticides, the herbicides, even the chemical fertilizers coming out of the explosive factories of the war. And Rachel Carson woke us up to that war machinery that had become the economy. We had Stockholm. 1992 was when all the movements of the world put pressure on governments. It wasn't the governments who led, it's the people who led. And we have the Earth Summit in Rio. And I remember how we were drafting these international treaties. We as activists were shaping the consciousness around the Convention on Biological Diversity, and we got that treaty. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, we got that agreement. Next year is going to be 20 years after Rio. What is happening? I am in New York because the United Nations General Assembly just organized a conference on harmony with nature, which is leading up to trying to balance the United Nations Declaration on the Human Rights with an awareness that nature also has rights, and we need a United Nations Declaration sooner or later on the rights of nature, and harmony with nature is the first step. So on the one hand, you've got people of the world, you've got the ancient indigenous cultures, civilizations like India, women of the world, and young people saying, we want to live within nature's limits, we want to recognize her gifts, we want to live better lives by using less. On the other hand, what we haven't learned is that a failed system of economy, a failed idea of reductionist science and technology has brought us the ecological crisis, and yet these are the very tools being offered as solutions to the environmental crisis. So you've got the pretense that genetic engineering is a solution to climate change. You've got the arrogance that engineering the entire planet through geoengineering will fix the problems of climate change, as if the sun was the problem, and therefore you've got to reflect the sunshine back up, either through mirrors or through sulfide pollutants. Worse still, there is the idea that the problem is we haven't commodified nature enough. So now, not only must we chop the trees and turn them into square feet of timber, we must now commercialize and commodify the oxygen the forests give us and create emissions trading schemes for the polluters to be able to buy up ecological services. And I think there are many things wrong with it. The first that's wrong is, here's a failed financial system and you're putting everything in its hands. Here are the polluters who should be punished, and you're saying you can control the planet by creating these trading schemes with ecological services. But what is worse is, we are at a moment where most of humanity is rising and saying we need a new harmony with nature, we need a new relationship with nature, not the predatory, poisoning relationship, not the idea of limitless growth on a limited planet, but the idea of perennial growth in nature with growth of our well-being, our health, our communities. So we have a huge contest in worldviews, and it's showing up everywhere, including the lead up to the Rio Plus 20 summit.
Thank you for that overview. It strikes me as somewhat odd that virtually all of our major governmental agencies, and not the least of which is our Environmental Protection Agency and the USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture, have sided with the polluters, not with the citizens group. We've always made the profit and interest of those who would exploit, commodify, and commercialize the environment more important than the effects or the unintended consequences to the citizens. Rachel Carson brought that out with DDT, showing that when all the scientists, and I remember there was a scientist named Dr. Jukes who was saying that it's completely safe, and some scientists, I don't know who it was, took a teaspoon of DDT and ate it and say, see, it's not a problem. And yet, we always have to challenge our governmental agencies to say there's a lot of good evidence that we are being harmed by what you're spraying into the air, what's on our soil. You are using us as human guinea pigs when it comes to genetic engineering. Shouldn't you have long-term studies independently confirmed and done before you allow these things into our environment? And without exception, I mean no exception, they're always siding with the people who in time, 5, 10, 30 years later, it was shown, gee whiz, we, the citizens, were right. They, the government overseers, and acting as apologists or propagandists for special interest groups, were wrong. Do you see this, and do you see the idea that maybe we should stop trusting authority from these institutions, which we seem to do constantly?
I think we can definitely see that as more and more spheres of our lives have been taken over by corporate greed, more and more spheres of government policy and law have been influenced by them to first and foremost push unhealthy, hazardous stuff, whether it be hazardous medicine or it be hazardous GMOs or it be hazardous pesticides. Just before I left India now, I was in Kerala, where 1,000 people have died and 60,000 are crippled because of the spraying of a lethal pesticide called endosulfan. And of course, the agriculture minister keeps saying it is safe, it is harmless. Those hundreds and thousands of people impacted don't count. That blindness comes from subservience to corporations. And I think the crisis of democracy that I've addressed in my book, Earth Democracy, is that we no more have independent governments. We have corporate governments, we have corporate states. And when corporations rule, they will contaminate science and knowledge, they will contaminate regulation, and they will definitely contaminate decision making, which is why we have to reclaim democracy. We've got to become doubtful about the legitimacy of the processes that are guided not by the will of the people as they should be in a democracy, but by the power of corporations.
Could you give us an understanding of what has happened in India with genetically engineered seeds, the promise that Monsanto and DuPont and others made, if you only use our seeds, how greater crop yields, greater profits, and then tell us the reality and the consequences of that, and then to the environment and to the lives of people directly impacted and how they got away with this?
The first genetically engineered crop that was brought to India was brought by Monsanto, and its trade name is Bolgard. It's a genetically engineered BT cotton in which the toxin from the Bacillus thuringiensis, a soil organism, has now been pulled out of the organism and put into the plant, so the plant makes its own toxin and becomes like a pesticide factory. The first time we realized this was happening was with big ads by Monsanto saying now the Indian farmers would be able to have access to this miracle seed, the Bolgard. I had been studying the genetic engineering phenomena globally. I'd done a book called on the Green Revolution, and I knew the laws of my country, so I rang up our ministry and said, did they get approval? And our Ministry of Environment said, no, they never came to us. So I immediately sued Monsanto in the courts, in the Supreme Court of India, to say they've entered illegally. That case went on for 4 years, and they weren't allowed to commercialize till 2002. But they started, meantime, to buy up the Indian seed industry, either directly or through joint ventures like with Mahiko, or through licensing arrangements. We've just done a study on the monopoly in the cotton seed supply. 95% of the cotton seed of India, where cotton originated, where we used to have 1,500 varieties of cotton, are now in the hands of Monsanto. Now, what does it mean for people, the farmers, and the environment? First and foremost, the cost of seed goes up. Seed used to cost between 5 to 10 rupees a kilogram in cotton. Monsanto seed costs about 4,000 rupees a kilogram. That's an 8,000% jump. The advertisements that sold this to the farmers talked about farmers becoming millionaires. They used false posters. They even used all our divinities and gods. And in India, of course, we have no dearth of them. We have 300 million divinities for the 300 million species on the planet. And so they could use Guru Nanak Dev, the founder of the Sikh religion in Punjab. They could use Hanumanji in Andhra Pradesh from the Ramayana, the monkey god. And they used the faith of people in their mythology, in their religious texts, to sell a toxic product. Of course, farmers would innocently go into this. They didn't have money in their pockets to buy such a costly seed. And they would be told, just put your thumbprint here on your papers and take credit against your land. 2 years down the road, the BT cotton would fail. There would be new pests. Every year the seed had to be bought, because unlike open pollinated farmers varieties that can be saved year in and year out, these genetically engineered hybrids have to be bought every year. The combination is that in 2 to 3 years the farmer is in such deep debt, and what is taken away from the farmer is their land. It's the day the agents of Monsanto and the chemical industry come to take the land from the farmer. The farmer moves quietly to his field, drinks the pesticide to end his life. 99% suicides of farmers are pesticide drinking suicides. 250,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide since corporations like Monsanto started to take control over the seed supply. We've lost our biodiversity, we are losing our farmers, and meantime, farmers are being pushed into such a vicious cycle. There's no alternative in the market. Monsanto is extremely clever. When it signs licensing arrangements with Indian farmers, with Indian companies, they ensure that they will only sell the BT cotton and not any of the other alternatives, not the open pollinated varieties and not the GM-free hybrids. Now, they're pushing every one of these companies to sell only Bolgard 2, because Bolgard 1 with one toxic gene has already failed to control the bollworm. It has become resistant. And now they're selling a Bolgard 2 at twice the price. We are fighting another case against Monsanto in the High Court of Andhra Pradesh, where the government is contesting Monsanto's right to charge what they want to. We are saying seed is an essential input to agriculture. Farmers' rights require that seed be affordable. That is why Monsanto cannot say, this is my intellectual property and I will claim what I want to, even if Indian farmers die. Monsanto's entry into India has led to a genocide, because 250,000 is not a trivial number. But because of that experience, when they tried to bring in the BT eggplant, which we call Brinjal in India, we mobilized nationwide and the environment minister was forced to hold public hearings and a moratorium was put on it. The moratorium is still in place. Every attempt to have it dislodged. In addition, Monsanto is now trying to get into every state to have agreements to take over the seed supply. The situation in India before Monsanto came was 80% seed farmer seed, 20% seed from the public system of agricultural universities. Now, as I mentioned, in cotton, we got 95% Monsanto. They'd like to create a similar scenario in corn, in vegetables. And that's why I created Navdanya, to save seeds, to defend farmers' rights, and to have an agricultural system that works with nature's laws, works for farmers and brings us healthy food. And our farmers earn 10 times more than the farmers using Monsanto's genetically engineered seeds.
Thank you for that overview. We're going to take a break and bring some of the individuals who you know on the program now to share their points of view. And also, I believe they have some questions they'd like to ask you. We'll have Dr. David Corton, Naomi Klein, and Jeffrey Smith joining us in a moment. Please stay with us.
Come and meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to. 42nd Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet. It's the song I love, the melody.
Heard all over the world. We are celebrating Earth Day with a special group of individuals who've committed a great deal of their time and energy to educating everyone who chooses to be educated about how intimate that relationship is between nature and ourselves, and how we frequently take it for granted, and what happens when others not only take it for granted but exploit it as if we have an unlimited amount of time. And we can repair what we've damaged whenever we choose. Not true. Dr. Vandana Shiva is in our studio in New York City. We have Dr. David Corton, Naomi Klein, and Jeffrey Smith. And let's go over now and say hello first to David Corton. And he is one of our nation's important visionary economists, historians, and critics of free market globalization in the progressive community. He is a former professor of Harvard University School of Business. And for several decades, he lived on different continents in international development projects, mostly in South and Southeast Asia. And he is a founder of Yes Magazine and the Positive Futures Network. And he's written many important books, most recently The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, and An Agenda for New Economy. His website is greatturning.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Gary, and good to connect with Vandana again.
Hello, David.
Could you please share with our guest and our audience your concerns about our environment on this Earth Day, and any of the issues that you would like to raise with Dr. Shiva, please do.
Well, I think the issues that you've been laying out are very foundational, and it so much of it comes back to the corporate control of our political system, and right on. I do have a couple of questions for Vandana. you've laid out an absolutely chilling scenario of how the supposed green revolution continues to play out in India. I'm wondering if you have any comments on the Gates Foundation Green Revolution Initiative in Africa. The other question, which is rather different, is in terms of the work that we've done together in on the building of a global movement, a resistance against corporate power, and the democratization of our governments. I'd be very interested in your current assessment of where that where we stand in that movement and what you see as currently the most promising openings for citizen action.
Gary, should I respond to David?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, all of our other guests are going to have questions for you, and I thought it'd be a great opportunity, since you are all friends, if you could answer their questions directly.
Thank you. I think, given the experience around the world, not just in India, but seeing what has happened to Argentina with the total monoculture of Roundup resistant soya, what's happened to farmers in the United States, what's happened to Africa with the spread of commercial agriculture, which has made Africa more vulnerable, as well as the alternatives that are so clearly available, alternatives of the kind we've generated in India through Navdanya. We've just released a report, it's available on our website, called Health Per Acre, showing that if you look at the nutritional output, then ecological systems produce far more than commodity-producing systems. It's only when you look at the commodity production that monocultures of corn and soya produce more. And the United Nations has just submitted a report showing that on African data, if Africa's initiatives in ecological farming were spread more, we could remove hunger by doubling food production in 3 years' time. Now, that's the evidence that an intelligent man who created a big company called Microsoft should be following. But he's not following that evidence. He's pushing chemicals. We know nitrogen fertilizer is a major problem for climate change because it emits nitrogen oxide, which is 300 times more damaging to climate instability than carbon dioxide. We've had the bad experience of genetically engineered seeds, the farmer suicides in India. He's pushing GMOs. We've seen how the land of Punjab, where the Green Revolution was first introduced, became a land of war. In the early days, a war against the system. Today, a war against the farmers themselves. Punjab is another epicenter of farmer suicides. I was there with the Bhutanese because we are helping Bhutan go 100% organic, and the farmers really wanted to visit Punjab, so I took them there. And one village, 100 suicides. Next village, 45 suicides. And the Bhutanese were puzzled. They said, the fields are full of grain, and yet the farmers are dying. Something is wrong with the system. And Mr. Gates should understand something's wrong with the system, and instead of pushing a system that destroys the environment, destroys small farmers, and destroys our health base in terms of nutritious food, I think it's a crime. I think it's wrong to use his money for something that has been proven to be anti-people and anti-environment. And I hope you're close to him, David. Get to talk to him.
Unfortunately not. He seems to be impervious to critical input, even from within his organization. It's a terrible shame, a terrible tragedy, because he could be doing so much good in the world.
And the interesting thing is, he and Warren Buffett just came to India for what they call the art of giving. Bill Gates is investing hugely in Monsanto. And Warren Buffett, while talking about giving, has invested in one of the biggest land grab phenomena in India, the largest ever investment for land grab, through what is called POSCO, a Korean steel company, in which he has major shares. So what we say is, stop the grabbing and then talk about the giving, because both of these individuals are grabbing hugely. And in the case of Africa, Mr. Gates, through his Alliance for the Green Revolution for Africa, is grabbing the freedom of the African people to make their choices. The small farmers associations across Africa have said we don't want this green revolution, and they come very frequently to visit us and our programs to see how a sustainable option can be strengthened. On your second question, David, we worked so much together to build the Seattle protests, the work we've done collectively in the International Forum on Globalization. And I think if the 90s and the early part of this century was dedicated to showing how what was called globalization was really corporate rule, and your books have contributed so much to this clarity, I think what we are moving to now is the positive articulation of what people want. How do we see ourselves on this planet? And on Mother Earth Day, I think I can say that the resurrection and resurgence of the recognition of the rights of Mother Earth is probably the biggest thing happening in human consciousness. Some people talk about giving rights to nature. That's pathetic. You can't give nature rights. Just as much as you can't give your mother life, she gives you life. It's an asymmetric relationship where we are dependent on the earth. She is not dependent on us, but we could be caring, we could build the soils, we could protect the biodiversity, we could conserve the water. And there is a role we have as human beings for maintaining the life systems. The way I look at it today, more and more people have got totally disillusioned with the old system. It's brought us financial collapse, it's bringing us climate catastrophe, it has created a food crisis. So no matter which way you look, the system that is still ruling has failed the people and it is failing the planet. But there's a tiny minority of people with a lot of power continuing to hold on. And we see that in India, we see that in the United States, the Koch brothers trying to kill all the initiatives in this country around climate responsibility. After all, the huge fossil fuel consumption of the United States has contributed to the melting of glaciers in the Himalaya from where I come. It has contributed to the extreme floods and droughts. And I think it is time for citizens globally, including citizens of the United States, to build the Earth democracy, to re-embed ourselves in the consciousness of an Earth community, and start to exercise our real power. And that's where the Middle East should give us inspiration. If out of the blue, people in Tunisia, people in Egypt can come out and say, this dictator must go, I think we need to do the same for the corporate dictatorship that is destroying the possibility of life on this planet.
Yeah, you may know, Vandana, that we're beginning to see a movement taking hold in the United States around the issue of corporate taxes and the corporate tax evaders. This is a very small piece of the larger puzzle, but it is a huge turnaround in the political conversation that I think is an important opening, and I believe it's partly inspired by what's happening in the Middle East. You know, I've been working increasingly around the idea that we need to take the biosphere as our metaphor for redesigning the economy to align our relationships with Earth and with each other in alignment with the dynamics and structure of Earth's biosphere, which of course is rooted in place everywhere and makes exquisitely efficient use of resources, but on a sustainable basis. And these ideas seem to be catching on. We're talking about not only living economies, but living enterprises, living communities, and of course your term, living democracy, which you popularized and which helped inspire all of this. So I think I have a sense that we are seeing a moment of rapid awakening that that we can build on, and it's a very important source of hope.
Thank you. Dr. David Corton, thank you. Please hold on. Let's go over now and say hello to Naomi Klein. As I mentioned earlier, she's an award-winning journalist, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, which was made into a documentary. And nice to have you with us today, Naomi Klein.
Very glad to be with you. Hi, David, and hi, Vandana.
Hi, Naomi.
Would you ask Vandana questions that you have, and also a question I have for you? What role do you see our continuing demand for globalization of resources playing into our environmental degradation? What role do you see globalization, which has been sponsored by both Democrats and Republicans, as being a cause for environmental degradation, overexploitation of our resources?
Yeah, well, it's a huge cause, obviously, because it's the most energy-intensive way that you could possibly manage an economy, and it in no way takes into account the environmental costs of ridiculous decisions to ship goods that we can produce in our backyards across the planet. And one of the things that I think there are wonderful reasons for hope, but coming back to what Vandana and David were just discussing about the sort of state of that the global resistance that used to be called the anti-globalization movement, but was always much more of an anti-corporate and really anti-capitalist movement. I find it bizarre that you have so much more awareness about climate change now, less discussion of trade policies. I mean, we were talking about this all the time in the late 90s and in 2000, 2001, but it's talked about a lot less by the big green environmental groups who talk about climate change all the time. I think in part because a lot of them are in partnerships with large corporations, and there's this idea that climate change can be this so-called postpartisan issue that isn't politically divisive, and that means not talking about economic models nearly as much as we should be talking about them. So obviously they're intimately connected, because globalization, which is, it's a slippery word. It's globalization of a particular economic, voracious economic model. So, of course, it is voraciously consuming the planet's resources. But what I really wanted to talk to Vandana about was, geoengineering and the role that agriculture can play as an alternative to geoengineering. I recently went to this absolutely bizarre conference hosted by the Royal Society as part of research I'm doing for a book and film, the Royal Society in England, and it was a conference about solar radiation management, which means managing the sun to reflect the sun's rays back into space. And this is being discussed very, very seriously now. It was a meeting that was co-hosted by not just the Royal Society, but also the Environmental Defense Fund, a very large environmental group based in the United States. And the meeting was about how to manage the research for these technologies. And the assumption seemed to be that it was inevitable. And I know, Vandana, that you've been very, very critical of these techno fixes. And I was hoping that you could talk about geoengineering and also talk about the role that the kind of agricultural models that you're involved with in India can naturally sequester carbon in the ways that these geoengineering techno fixes are trying to do artificially and at tremendous risk.
For those who are offering geoengineering solutions for climate change, they need to just look at two or three things. One, last year in April, precisely a year ago, I know this because I was to go to Cochabamba for the release of this Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth, but we have the volcano in Iceland that brought all travel to a halt in Europe and any transit through Europe. One of the geoengineering solutions is creating artificial volcanoes. And the problem is, this is what I have called monocultures of the mind and one-dimensional thinking. The real problem is, here's a very beautiful and complex planet. We have put too much carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxide, and methane into the atmosphere, way beyond the recycling capacity of the planet's biosphere. So the real solution is reduce those emissions. There's no other solution. for the one-dimensional Cartesian mind of a monoculture thinking. The problem is the sun is heating up the planet rather than that we are preventing its heat to be released because of the greenhouse effect, therefore block the sun. And I've been at debates with many of these geoengineers, and I remember asking them, one of them, I said, okay, you block the sun, and where will the food come from? Because ultimately all food is a result of photosynthesis, and for photosynthesis we need the sun. And they said, oh, we didn't think of that. So they don't think about the vitality of the sun in keeping the earth alive. They've defined the sun as a problem, and worse, the arrogance of thinking they can manage the sun. They haven't even managed to manage the affairs on this planet in their narrow spheres. Wall Street hasn't managed to manage the financial economy. The agricultural scientists who've developed chemical farming and industrial agriculture haven't managed the agroecosystems. Now, my book, Soil Not Oil, traces two things. First, that 40% of the climate problem is the problem of emissions from an industrial globalized agriculture. And therefore, 40% of the solution is to make agriculture ecological in its production methods and localized in its distribution systems. In the process, we actually produce more food and we produce healthier food. So only thing coming in the way of the real solution for climate change, which can get rid of the madness of genetic engineering, is ecological farming. But that would mean Monsanto doesn't get to sell its GM seeds. The chemical industry doesn't get to sell its pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers. That war industry is really what's coming in the way, and we've got to get them out of the way of getting on with the business of growing food in ways that work for the planet and ways that work for humanity.
Thank you, Anna.
Do you have any other questions, Naomi?
Well, just going a little deeper into this, I mean, it is so extraordinary. Vandana, you debated Gwynne Dyer a while back on this question, and it was really interesting because you were making the argument that we know this about ecological farming, and it is tested, it's tested and tested for thousands of years, and we have this information, and it isn't high risk, it's low risk, and yet he dismissed that as unrealistic, as politically unrealistic, while these techniques are being held up as a solution, these geoengineering fixes, which are entirely untested and unknown, and even the scientists admit that they have no idea what the results could be. You could reflect the sun's rays back to space by putting sulfur in the stratosphere, as they're talking about, and they know that one of the risks of this is that it would mess with Asia's monsoon season, and that they know that when there have been large volcanoes, that it has caused droughts in Africa. So this is known. So if they're trying to imitate a volcano, this is not a side effect. This is an effect. So I just wanted to ask you whether you have any insights into the frame of thinking that would choose such a high risk route, such an untested route, over one that is tested and known, and but call that realistic.
I think what the frame of thinking that drives both the geoengineers and the genetic engineers is first and foremost the very false idea of engineering. You know, when you experiment recklessly with the planet and its complexity, or you experiment recklessly with the life of living organisms, and you call it engineering, you are pretending to yourself and to the world that you are putting an automobile together where the parts are given, the outcome is fixed. That's not the way it works. The parts, you don't even know what are the elements and components of the ecosystems that maintain the climate. You're not aware of the amazing diversity of gene ecology, epigenetics that keeps life in the organism going. So it's ignorance of the complexity, simplistic, actually highly immature thinking. And with it, two other diseases and pathologies we have developed. One, that money, corporate money, becomes the decider. So the corporations will be behind financing these research projects, and anywhere where big money pours, you can make a scientist do anything. If these scientists had to be held responsible for their actions and accountable to society, rather than be given a freebie through huge funding, they would all stop. And that's why I basically say scientists are part of society, not above society, and need to be accountable. They need to get permission from society. That would be public science. That would be authentically public accountability. But there's a second mindset, and that mindset is the false idea that once you've got a PhD, you don't have to listen to anyone. You are now an expert. And the rule of corporations goes hand in hand with the rule of experts. We just put out a manifesto on knowledge sovereignty. And what we are basically saying is that every person knows. The poorest peasant knows how to do farming. If my shoe is pinching, I know it's pinching. No one else can tell me it's pinching. And that is why we must treat every citizen as an expert and remove this authoritarian structure that is allowing this experimentation with life on this planet.
Thank you. Let's go over and say hello to our final panelist, Jeffrey Smith. He is certainly one of our foremost experts on health and environmental risks of genetically modified organisms, and is a leading watchdog over corporate agriculture industry's manipulation of GMO, genetic science, and public opinion. He is also founding director of the Institute for Responsible Technology, and he's the author of Seeds of Deception, as well as Genetic Roulette. Nice to have you with us today, Jeffrey.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Hello, Vandana.
Jeffrey, please ask the questions and share your thoughts, same timing. And could either of you address this issue? Today, Bill Gates, and by the way, we sent an enormous package, professionally prepared, of material to Bill Gates on the danger of promoting genetically engineered seeds in Africa and India. We also sent him information on what really needs the people of Africa need to regain health and sustainability. We never got a response. In any case, but they all say that the great success of the Green Revolution, they keep heralding back to the success of the Green Revolution is why we should continue forward, and they're the experts, no one else. Could you share your concerns about the so-called success of the Green Revolution?
Why don't you start with that, Vandana, and I'll add something from the World Food Prize day that I picked up as well.
Sure. I'm basically trained as a physicist. I never imagined I'd be spending so much of my life looking at agriculture. And what threw me in the agriculture field was the tragedies of 1984, the Bhopal disaster, and the violence in Punjab, which took 30,000 lives, an extremism we had never known, six times 9/11. And the Green Revolution had been given a Nobel Peace Prize, but here was Punjab, a land of war. So I was doing consulting for the United Nations University, and I said, I'd like to look at this. And that's how I did the book for the UN called The Violence of the Green Revolution. The first thing about the Green Revolution is it only looked at rice and wheat, and we have done calculations that show that you could have grown that kind of rice and wheat in a monoculture using traditional seeds and organic farming. It wasn't the seed and the chemical from the Green Revolution, but the increased water through huge amounts of irrigation projects that were developed, including the Bhakra Dam, as well as the increased acreage under the rice and wheat monocultures. So it's land and water that explain the phenomena, not the seed and chemicals. Secondly, actually food production went down in Punjab. If you include all of the different produce that Punjab grew, the chickpea, the makki ki roti and the saag, sarso ka saag, all of that has disappeared. Today, Punjab has very severe levels of childhood malnutrition. Today, Punjab has such high levels of cancer that there's actually a train that leaves Punjab called the cancer train. The groundwater has disappeared and what little remains is totally contaminated. The biodiversity is gone and the farmers, as I mentioned, are committing suicide. This is not a success. This is an ecological tragedy, it is an agrarian tragedy, and it is a tragedy for the future generations of Punjab that has no hope, which is why we've started Seeds of Hope and Gardens of Hope in places like Punjab, in places like Vidarbha, to bring back seeds that can give you real prosperity and production through ecological methods and the creation of local markets.
I'd like to add to that. I attend the World Food Prize Day from time to time. It happens to take place in Iowa, where I live. And there, Norman Borlaug, before he passed, was always touted as the father not only of the Green Revolution, but a great savior of the planet. And the people there have absolutely no regard for the points that you're making, Vandana. In fact, there was one researcher that sheepishly pointed out that there was a big malnutrition imbalance in the region because the diet was skewed towards the now cheaper grains that were the product of the Green Revolution and depriving people of the biodiversity and nutritional effects of a more diverse diet. And that was completely ignored. He mentioned it from the podium and no one else referred to it and no one else picks it up. So what it was is a revolution that promoted agricultural inputs that allowed companies to expand their markets into India and other places. And that is the reason why there's so much institutional support for it. It makes it very convenient to have this reductionist, non-systematic viewpoint. So it is an unfortunate thing that the information that goes out to the world is skewed largely by the public relations and advertising firms of those companies that gain the most from the so-called Green Revolution.
And Gary, the Green Revolution was imposed on India in 1965. We had a drought. We needed to import a little more wheat. It isn't that our farming systems had collapsed. But the United States said, we will not send you wheat unless you make your agriculture totally chemical and accept the Green Revolution. Our Prime Minister of that time, Lal Bahadur Shastri, said, no, we cannot experiment on such a large scale with your chemicals. We will do it on a small scale, and if it works, we will spread it. Lal Bahadur Shastri died under mysterious circumstances in Tashkent, and the conditionalities were used with a joint combination of pressure from the U.S. government, the World Bank, and USAID and Rockefeller Foundation aid to impose a totally non-green, anti-green, non-revolution on a country which is such an important agrarian society. And it is so sad that 30 years after its failure is known, where the farmers are paying a price with their lives, the myth of the Green Revolution continues to create tragedies in other parts of the world.
Thank you. Jeffrey, questions for Donashi, please.
Yes. What I've seen, I've been crisscrossing the United States for 8 years, speaking about GMOs, and I have never seen such an upsurge of consumer awareness, concern, and information as I have since starting at the beginning of 2010. It was actually predicted to happen by Supermarket News. Now we also have, on top of the general education, the GE salmon issue, the alfalfa and the sugar beets have pushed the arguments up into the media, and we have new research showing, for example, that in the blood and fetuses of pregnant women, there's the BT toxin that's produced in corn. There's evidence showing toxicity in the livers and kidneys. There was that hamster study out of Moscow that showed by the third generation fed on genetically modified soy, most of the hamsters lost the ability to have babies. Roundup, which is now drenched in most of the GM crops, is now linked to birth defects, endocrine disruption, etc. And the American Academy of Environmental Medicine urges all doctors to prescribe non-GMO diets to all patients. So what I'm seeing in the United States is a buzz that's rising to a roar. And I'm wondering, Vandana, if you see signs of this similar transformation in other parts of the world as you travel, because I've been focused mostly on the U.S. in the last 2 years.
Definitely, Jeffrey. Around the world, people are becoming more and more aware. For example, I was just in Rajasthan, where Monsanto has signed an MOU with the Rajasthan government, and organizations that never bothered about what's happening in agriculture or the seed sector are suddenly turning to us and saying, can you brief us? Can you tell us what will be the implication? So as Monsanto and the biotech industry pushes and imposes GM seeds on farmers and GM foods on consumers, more and more people respond with their democratic rights and says, we don't want to be force-fed with these toxics. And I think the only thing that can prevent this raw that you're talking about from becoming a transforming raw is very, very fascist, very dictatorial steps to prevent people from having a choice and having a say in what they grow and what they eat.
In the U.S., we're sort of not only pushing for labeling, but providing non-GMO shopping guides so that we create a consumer revolution. We think a tipping point can happen with as little as 5% of U.S. shoppers avoiding GM ingredients. And that way, we are not relying upon the government to sort of bail us out from the GMOs. In fact, the Obama administration, tragically, has been more pro-GMO, perhaps, than even the Bush administration. They put Michael Taylor in as U.S. food safety czar, and Michael Taylor was Monsanto's former attorney, then went to the FDA in 92 and said no testing was necessary on GMOs and no labeling, then became Monsanto's vice president, and now he's in charge of the safety of U.S. food. So it does not bode well for a political solution, but we think in this case, a kind of living democracy in the hands of people voting with their dollars, and in fact, as you talk about a revolution in the kitchen, I think we're going to see that in the United States very soon.
One other question for you, Jeffrey, if you would, please. And then I would like Naomi Klein and David Corton to each ask a final question or make a final statement. We have 5 minutes left in our program. When you're out there and you're bringing the information of what you and others have found of the challenges against the safety and efficacy of genetically modified food, and you see that the deck is stacked. They have all the important positions, policymaking positions, Monsanto and DuPont do, covered in this administration. Why hasn't the American media been more open to having a full, objective, independent review of the actual claims being made by Monsanto and then the claims being made by yourself and others, and let them see that we are not getting an honest story here?
There's been a consistent under-reporting on GMO health risks in the United States. Back when the fraud at the FDA was exposed because thousands of documents made public from a lawsuit showed that the scientists themselves had urged their superiors to require studies, the major media showed up to the press conference in 1999 in D.C. and told the organizer, this should be front page news, but it will be buried. And in fact, it was buried. When Fox TV was going to do a four-part news series on bovine growth hormone out of their Florida station, a threatening letter from Monsanto's attorney promising dire consequences to Fox and Rupert Murdoch ultimately buried the series. And when Dr. Arpad Pusztai's gag order was lifted in Europe and 750 articles were written about GMOs there, forcing a tipping point of consumer rejection in 1999, the consumer watchdog group, the media watchdog group Project Censored, described it as one of the 10 most underreported events of the year in the United States, where most people don't realize they've ever eaten a GMO in their lives. So the fact is there is a de facto censorship on GMO health risk information, and that can be tied to corporate ownership of the media as well as potential loss of advertising revenues. And I haven't seen a real good map of how the biotech industry's influence is on the board of directors and others in the media, but it wouldn't be too difficult to establish that, I believe.
Thank you. Naomi Klein, final thoughts or question?
Yeah, I'd just say that I think what the work that Vandana is doing around the rights of nature and the rights of Mother Earth are so crucial to all the issues that we've been discussing, because I think what connects them all is this narrative that we've been stuck in for 300 or so years since the scientific revolution, really longer, that tells us this is the Francis Bacon's idea that the earth is a machine and that it is to be dominated by us and controlled by us or by the art and hand of man, as he said, so not all of us. And as fossil fuels deplete and the easily accessible fossil fuels run out,
we are taking this thinking to such extremes and taking higher and higher risks to extract the last remaining fossil fuels, whether it's deep water drilling or the tar sands, and then we are trying to fix the messes we made with ever more high-risk technologies like nuclear power, and we're seeing the results of that in Japan. So, you know, what we really need is another story about who we are on this planet and what our relationship is with the Earth, and that isn't this relationship of domination. And so I think we have to keep fighting on the individual issues, but at the same time, we also need to be fighting at the narrative level, at the big picture narrative level, and that's why I think the work that Vandana is doing on that front is just so important and so exciting.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful to talk with all of you.
Thank you, Naomi Klein, Jeffrey Smith, Dr. David Corton. I'm sorry, but we just hit the top of the hour. And, of course, Dr. Vandana Shiva, all of you for sharing these important insights on this important day, Earth Day, an Earth Day special. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway. Hip hooray and ballyhoo, the lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of the subway train, the rattle of the taxis, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's when a Broadway night. It's early in the morning. Manhattan babies don't sleep tight until the dawn. Good night, baby. Good night. Milkman's on his way. Sleep tight.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.